You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to Stupidity, home of the greatest media mind ever to walk the planet.
I tell you what, man, he's a literal titan across the entire media landscape.
Okay, so here's the deal. He's a true icon in every sense of the word.
He's loved and feared more than any being to grace this planet.
There's two guys. A man with a voice that sounds like Barry White and Beyonce had a Jewish baby.
God himself would pay $39.99 for a cameo. Fact of the matter is, you are about to embark on a transcendent experience that can only be described as psychological nudity.
This is Stugatz, and this is Stupidity.
Here we go, Jim.
Tony!
Mikey, I'm not certain when the last time is that we released an episode of Stupidity. It feels like pre-Super Bowl, am I right? I mean, I have no idea.
It's been a minute. It's been a while.
You're right. So do I. I miss it too. Just became too busy around Super Bowl week, and I'm still recovering from Las Vegas. Keith O'Brien is a New York Times best-selling author. He's the best-selling author of Fly Girls. He has a new book out, Charlie Hustle, The Rise and Fall of Pete Rose, and The Last Glory Days of Baseball. Holy shit, did he nail the timing on a Pete Rose book. This is the definitive Pete Rose book. Opening day is here. The Shohei Ohtani news. I mean, this is the perfect time to write a book about Charlie Hustle. And one of the best writers we have, Keith O'Brien, has written the definitive book here. And we'll talk to him in just a second. Phil Heath is going to join us as well in this episode. Phil Heath,
big.
He's a man.
Yes.
He's everything you and I are not. In so many ways.
But I was intimidated on the Zoom.
Yes, I know. So was I. I was scared. I was nervous. I was nervous to speak to Phil Heath, but turned out to be a really nice guy and a fun guy.
Yeah.
Mike, are you interested? You're still interested. Once upon a time, kids, baseball was our most popular sport, and Pete Rose was the most popular guy in the most popular sport. And then he had gambling issues and his downfall, and they're well documented, and he's not in the Hall of Fame. But you're excited to speak to this guy. He has access to Pete Rose and the inner circle of Pete Rose when he was playing with the Cincinnati Reds. And not many people, in fact, no one has ever gotten the access that Keith O'Brien has gotten here with Pete Rose. But you're excited for this, right? Because you're from a time where baseball was popular.
Yeah, and you know, it's amazing to me how Pete Rose is known for one thing, but there's so much more before the gambling thing ever happened that is so interesting that I'm looking forward to hearing about.
Yeah, it's interesting because if you didn't watch him growing up and you hear the name Pete Rose, you think about betting, you think about banned from baseball, you think about not making it to the Hall of Fame. This is one of the greatest baseball players to ever live, to ever play a sport where being good 30% of the time gets you to the Hall of Fame. I mean, it's a hard sport, and Pete Rose is one of the best to ever play it. But We digress here because, Mikey, I have top five people in sports in honor of Pete Rose. Top five people in sports you just don't trust.
I can think of a few names. Oh, man. Okay, who you got? I can't wait for this.
Yeah. All right, again, this is the top five people in sports history that you just don't trust. Okay. Oh, you ready?
I don't want to say any names because I don't want to ruin if you have them on there.
Okay. All right. So don't say any. Number five. Just, you know what? If I left any off, just let me know. Okay.
Sure.
Number five, the New York Jets.
That's not a person.
I don't care.
I mean, you're right, but that's not a person.
Whoever's running the New York Jets. Is that fair? Fair. The Jets. Okay. The Jets. Number okay. four. Number four. Number five, Jets. Number four, me.
That's I'm surprised. I'm surprised you're that low.
It was one of the names you were thinking of, right?
Yes.
Thank you. No, asshole. Number three, Pete Rose. Yep. A charmer. I get it. You know, he's a very charming individual. Pete Rose.
But he's a liar.
But he's a liar.
He's a liar.
As Keith O'Brien will tell you here in a few minutes. Number three is Pete Rose. Number two, all college football coaches. Every one of them.
Can we just put / Jimbo Fisher? Because like,
I especially feel like Jimbo Fisher.
That's one we need to like single out.
Especially Jimbo Fisher and that phony from Penn State. Franklin. That guy. Oh, no, I trust football coaches. Okay, go ahead. You trust Urban Meyer. Go ahead. Have fun.
Man, Urban Meyer. Oh, that's such a great one. I hope it's he's number great, one.
I listen, I could have done five football coaches here.
Yeah, you could.
Is there a group of people in America that you distrust more than college football coaches? Seriously. Like, I'm not certain. Put all the used car salesmen to the left and all the college football coaches to the right and sprint to the group that you trust more. I'm going to the used car salesman.
Used car salesman. 10 times out of 10.
Holy shit, that's funny. And number one, of course, top five people in sports you just don't trust. Number one, Rick Pitino.
That's a good one.
I don't trust him. No. If I'm the NCAA, I don't trust him. If I'm another coach, I don't trust him. If I'm one of his players, I don't trust him. If I'm his wife. How about that?
No, no. I don't trust him if I'm a busboy at an Italian restaurant.
No, not for 14 seconds. I don't trust that guy. Anyway, let's get to Keith O'Brien. Again, New York Times bestselling author, Fly Girls, Charlie Hustle's his new book. It's out right now, opening day right around the corner, the Ohtani News. It's The Rise and Fall of Pete Rose and the Last Glory Days of Baseball. And Keith O'Brien is a very busy man. Wrote me a handwritten note that we'll get to in just a second, but he joins us now. Stu Gatz here for my friends over at Miller Lite. A lot's changed over the years. One thing that hasn't, the great taste of Miller Lite. Another thing that hasn't changed is that it's less filling. So, what is the best thing about the original light beer? Miller Lite sparked this debate in 1975, and we still haven't settled it. For me, it is simple. What I want out of my light beer is ice cold and great taste, and that's exactly what I get from the original light beer, Miller Lite. Miller Lite keeps it simple, undebatable quality, great taste, only 96 calories. It's the beer that strips away everything you don't need and holds on to what matters most, a light beer that tastes like beer. You don't have to choose what's best. Miller Lite has great taste and is less filling. Tastes like Miller time. To get Miller Lite delivered right to your door, visit MillerLite.com/stew, or you can find it pretty much anywhere that sells beer. Celebrate responsibly. Miller Brewing Company, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, 96 calories per 12 ounces. Fewer calories and carbs than premium regular beer. All right, Keith O'Brien is with us. He is a New York Times bestselling author, the author of Fly Girls. He's with us right now, has a new book out, Charlie Hustle, The Rise and Fall of Pete Rose, and The Last Glory Days of Baseball. It's out right now, wherever you purchase your books. Mikey, this is a writer, okay? He sent me a copy of the book. Here's the book. It's beautiful. It's beautiful, okay? Beautiful. He sent me a handwritten note. I love a good handwritten note. But I imagine, what are you laughing at, Mikey? I love a good handwritten note.
I agree. Leave it to a writer to give you a handwritten note. You know what I mean? You know, a media person doesn't do that.
No, I would never do that. Not just any writer, a New York Times best-selling author. But look at the handwriting. Look at the penmanship on this. I was so jealous. Keith, how many of these handwritten notes have you written over the years? Seriously, this is beautiful.
Thank you, Stugatz. That is awesome. I had no idea that my handwritten note would impress you so much. I would have written you three.
Right. Listen, it's 2024, Keith. How many handwritten notes am I getting these days? I mean,
well, you know, that's a great way to stand out, though, isn't it? You know, yes. A little handwritten note.
Yes. How many times have you written a handwritten note? And because you're a New York Times bestselling author and a perfectionist, and you know there's an expectation that comes with these notes, have you written it, ripped it up, and tried again?
Yes, I have. Even though that piece of stationery right there costs about $1, I have thrown that out. Absolutely.
Why is this book about Pete Rose, Keith? How is this book different than all the other Pete Rose books that are out there? Because this is different. This is what I would say is the definitive book on Pete Rose.
Well, I think it's different in a few critical ways. For starters, I did get unprecedented access to Pete Rose, and more importantly, unprecedented access to the men in his inner circle. You know, Pete granted me interviews for about 27 hours before he did stop calling me back. But in that time, I was able to press him on lots of things and try to get to the why of things. And just as important as the Rose interviews were the interviews with many other people who've never spoken before. The guys who placed his bets on baseball, mistresses he slept with for years. And I also, relied on thousands of pages of previously unutilized federal court documents, because that's part of the story here, Pete Rose goes down in 1989, not for something that happened 3 weeks earlier, and not even for something that he was exactly doing, that Pete wasn't placing his bets with bookies. Other guys were doing it for him. But the men in this inner circle doing Pete's bidding in the mid-1980s started to get monitored by federal agents, specifically the FBI in Cincinnati. Each of them would face some sort of federal charge. And so there were thousands of pages of court documents that sort of helped me tell a story of a man's fall. And I guess the last thing I'll say, Stugatz, about this is, obviously it's a baseball story. And there's a ton of baseball in the book, but I never really saw it as a baseball narrative. This is a story of a man. And when you think of Pete Rose as a story of a man, well, now it's a lot more interesting.
Sure. How'd you get access to guys who previously haven't, but his inner circle? How'd you get access to those guys?
Well, so I was born and raised in Cincinnati, and that helped.
Right.
When I first started the project, I started doing interviews with guys in Cincinnati. I didn't try to get an interview with Johnny Bench out of the gate or try to get an interview with Pete Rose out of the gate. I did interviews with, guys I knew were close friends of his. And it was through those interviews that I got an introduction to Pete. And, once I was talking to Pete, he did for a time open doors for me. I want to be clear, he had and doesn't have any editorial control here, which is probably why he did stop calling me back. But when he started open doors and the men in his inner circle, picked up the phone and were happy to talk to me.
Were there things that you were writing that Pete was not happy with? Was he trying to have editorial control?
He never tried. No. And because I wouldn't have given it if he had.
Sure.
In our interviews, obviously I tried to cover everything. And one thing I think all of us have forgotten, frankly, even me to a certain extent before I started this, and even baseball fans, I think we've all forgotten who he once was.
Yes.
Yeah. He's like become a caricature of himself in the last, 15, 20 years. And we think of him that way now, as this sort of sad guy, at the casino, shouting at the clouds, shouting at the sky, in the hinterlands of his own sport. But one thing I wanted to do was go back and place the reader place us back in this time. And he was, whether we like him or not, whether we defend him or not, he was absolutely an American icon. Yes. And he was one of the greatest players, and especially the most exciting players of the 20th century. And so to go back and bring him to the mountaintop was important, you know, bring him, you know, all the way up to his glory years, and then watch him fall, often through his own decisions and his own choices, you know, was the goal from the outset with the book.
Keith O'Brien is with us, New York Times bestselling author. Charlie Hustle, The Rise and Fall of Pete Rose and The Last Glory Days of Baseball is out right now wherever you purchase your books. Keith, explain to the audience, because it's such a great point, and kids who are listening right now, yes, once upon a time, baseball was our biggest sport. It was not football. Pete Rose was the biggest star, one of the biggest stars in that sport. What did Pete Rose represent for the audience, for the portion of this audience who does not realize that? Baseball was popular at one point. Pete Rose was its most popular player. Explain to the audience just how big Pete Rose was and what he represented.
So that name of the book, Charlie Hustle, is Pete's nickname, obviously. And it's his whole persona. You know, this man who would, run through a wall to try to score a run, a man who would sprint down to first on a walk, a man who got into fights at second base, you know, just trying to break up a double play. And people loved him for all these things. You know, Pete Rose, you know, wins multiple World Series, multiple batting titles, an MVP. He's the all-time hit record holder, obviously. But even if he didn't have those things, he still would have been iconic. And so he represented a real American story, you know, because he was, you know, working class, because he was not so obviously talented, because he was not athletic at all. And yet these things happen. And so that whole story, the story of if you hustle, if you work hard, if you play hard, good things will happen for you no matter who you are. That is an American story. And so, you know, he represents that writ large for all of us in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. And he does so at a time when baseball is rapidly changing. I think another thing we've forgotten is that, you know, when Pete was signed as a minor league rookie and sent to Geneva, New York, as a minor leaguer in June 1960, baseball was still predominantly white, you know, and yes, there were a handful of, you know, Black and Latino stars, but it was predominantly white. And in the time that Pete is, you know, climbing his way to the mountaintop and becoming, you know, one of baseball's best players, that changes too. You know, baseball becomes much more diverse. You know, by the 1970s, most of the big stars are Latino and Black. And at that time, Pete now starts to represent something else for a certain segment of fans. He's the old guard. He's the past. Or even as Pete once said, you know, he's the great white hope.
What were some of the gambling details as we get into the gambling portion of this? Because, well, that's Pete's downfall. It was his vice. He had many vices. But what were some of the gambling details that you stumbled upon while putting this book together that you were like, you were shocked by, Keith?
Many. For starters, I got to say, even though Pete, you know, did shut me down and ultimately, you know, freeze me out, he did talk to me about things that he hasn't talked about in depth before. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I can now say, not just through those interviews, but through interviews with others and court documents, that Pete Rose's gambling with bookies goes back to at least the early 1970s. Mm-hmm. I'm not suggesting that he was betting on baseball in the early 1970s, but he was betting with bookies. And, you know, in the early iterations of his gambling with bookies on football and basketball, you know, a lot of these guys are Cincinnati guys like himself, you know, West Side guys from his neighborhood. And, you know, they're not going to chase him down and, you know, rat him out. And specifically, one of his first bookies was a man named Alphonse Esselman, who's part of the book. Al Esselman's been dead for years. But he was one of Pete's first bookies, and Esselman gets in trouble in Cincinnati multiple times with law enforcement, with federal investigators, And, you know, he would have had a chance, Al Esselman would have, to maybe turn some evidence over to authorities in the early 1970s about who was gambling with him. He doesn't. He protects Pete Rose. And, you know, as it goes on, Pete sort of starts to graduate into, let's just say, more serious bookmakers, you know, guys on the edge of organized crime, guys who don't live in Cincinnati, guys in New York and beyond. And based on my reporting, Sugatz, by the mid-1980s, it is going off the rails. I mean, we're talking about a guy who is betting on 8 to 10 to 12 games a day. You know, a guy who's betting $25,000-$30,000 a day.
Damn.
And you know, based on my reporting, not just with interviews, but with notes from a betting notebook that one of his guys kept in 1986, Pete at that point is losing as much as $30,000 a week. Ooh. And, you know, this was at a time when he was making as his salary about $500,000. So he's losing in a week, roughly 10% of his salary. And so, you know, what does Pete Rose do at that point? Well, he would do what a lot of gamblers would do. He starts betting on the thing he knows best. At least by early 1986, he's betting on baseball based on my reporting.
Wow. Amazing. I wish you still had access to him, because I'm certain you tried to reach out to him to get his thoughts on Ohtani. There's a cruel humor in all this. Like Calvin Ridley, he bets on his own sport and gets 4 years, $90 million. Pete is signing autographs in a strip mall in Vegas. I mean, it's crazy.
I mean, the world has changed so much.
I know.
And I just sort of feel like at this point, with everything that's happening this week, you know, we've got the Shohei Ohtani situation with his interpreter. We got the gambling investigation into the NBA, right? I mean, headlines everywhere about who's doing what with bookies or gambling platforms. It's like, I honestly feel like this is just going to be the new world order. This is what we're going to be dealing with now going forward.
Yeah. Should Pete be in the Hall of Fame?
So, you know, one reason why my book is different, too, is I don't take sides in the book. You know, if you like Pete Rose, you'll find things you like. If you don't like Pete Rose, you'll find things you like. And I don't take sides on the whole Hall of Fame debate in the book. But of course, I have thought a lot about it.
Of course.
We all have. I mean, it's one of the great late night sports bar arguments of all time.
It seems completely illogical to me, Keith, that the hit king in a sport where hitting is, you got to hit, right? This guy has a career average over 300. He's the hit king. And to not be in the Hall of Fame to me is ludicrous.
I mean, at this point, my feeling on the whole question is that I just feel like we've lost our perspective.
Yeah.
You know, we like to put these guys on pedestals and ascribe to them moral values that they may or may not have. And you know, at the end of the day, they're just often just guys who were really good at playing a little kid's game. And so, you know, for that reason, for me anyway, I believe that players should be enshrined or not enshrined based on what they did on the field. And if what they did off the field is so terrible, if their mistakes are so egregious, then I think we should put it on the plaque at Cooperstown, you know, put it in bronze, you know, right next to their achievements.
I like that. Here's all the negative shit about the Hall of Famer you're looking at right now. That's a good idea. Like,
it would never happen. It would never happen.
Do you like Pete?
Good question. Pete has a thing about him that you've probably noticed in other people that you've met over the years. He's got a charisma that is almost palpable when you're sitting across from him. And somebody asked me, oh, did he try to charm you? And I said, he didn't try to charm me. Pete's just sort of charming.
You know, right. Yes.
He's got like a thing, you know? And in that way, I was glad that I got the chance to meet him and spend time with him. And I was glad that I got the chance to sit across the table from him, asking him questions about his life. Because when I did interviews with other people, oftentimes people who had once been in his inner circle, but were no longer anymore, they were no longer receiving his love and attention. Many times in those interviews, people became emotional. They broke down crying, just thinking about the past, thinking about the times they had spent, you know, in Pete Rose's life. And I think that's just stunning. You know, I mean, I've been fortunate to interview, you know, thousands of people over the years. And of course, sometimes those interviews become emotional, maybe because something really tragic has happened, like a death. And so I did not expect that kind of emotion in the interviews I did for my book, but it happened again and again. And I think it's because Pete does have that thing. He's got a thing and a charisma that when you feel it, does make you feel important to him.
I'm curious, how do those interviews go? I mean, you sit down with him and you know you want to get to some of the things that he might not want to reveal or talk about right away. How do you kind of get there when you do these interviews?
Well, you know, especially when you're taking on a big project like this where I know I want to tell the whole story, I mostly moved chronological. You know, let's talk about your childhood in Cincinnati. Let's talk about your father. Let's talk about your high school years. And so in that way, you know, it sort of moved in a direction that we weren't initially talking about the gambling. But of course, we did get there. And there were other times where we'd be in the middle of an interview about not gambling, and suddenly, you know, he would, you know, go off on a tangent remembering something about gambling or ranting about someone who had, you know, once wronged him or maybe had led to his banishment. So, you know, and then if he did that, then we would linger there and stay there. But obviously, you know, Pete has one version of events that he likes to tell. And my job in trying to do this book was to push him on that version of events. And, you know, the big question I kept coming back to time and time again with Pete was why, you know, why weren't you honest, you know, when they first called you in for a secret meeting to say, hey, are you betting on baseball? Why weren't you honest 10 weeks later when John Dowd, the special counsel that was hired to investigate him, has a 2-day deposition in the basement of a Catholic church in Dayton, Ohio, and in which Dowd literally just lays out all the evidence he has gathered, you know, the bank records, the phone records, depositions with his bookie, depositions with the guy who had placed his bets. Why not be honest then? You know, try to get inside what I would, you know, call his darkness. And I don't want to overplay that. I think all of us have darkness, you know, that regret or that sadness in our life. And, you know, Pete, you know, loves to tell the good stories, but getting him to talk about the darkness was a big key here. Because as I told him from the outset of the project, if you are honest with people, And you let them into your darkness, they still may not like you. They still may not want to, you know, put you in the Hall of Fame or forgive you, you know, but they might appreciate you more. They might understand how we got here more.
Yeah, it's an endearing quality if he's able to do it, but he's not. How much does not being in the Hall of Fame haunt him till this day? Does it still bother him?
It does. You know, in one of the more sort of haunting exchanges with me at one of his favorite diners in Las Vegas, you know, over a very, very long lunch, we talked a little bit about that. And Pete, you know, said, you know, to me, and I'm paraphrasing here, you know, people don't know how this has made me feel. You know, people don't know what my life has been like. You know, people say these things and they don't know me. And about specifically, you know, the Hall of Fame and not being there or just not having access to the Reds clubhouse, not being able to go into the batting cage with a Cincinnati Reds prospect all these many years. Pete said, it drives me crazy. It drives me crazy.
Keith, we'll get you out of here. This is fascinating to me. Keith O'Brien with us, New York Times bestselling author, author of Fly Girls, his new book, Charlie Hustle, The Rise and Fall of Pete Rose, and The Last Glory Days of Baseball is out right now. All this is fascinating to me. Do you think if Pete was honest with Dad, with the commissioner in those secret meetings, do you think if he was honest on the front end of this, that he's in the Hall of Fame today?
I would say without question. And wow. That's not an opinion.
Right.
I did a lot of reporting around that first meeting in February 1989, where they called him in to ask him, you know, when nobody knew what was happening still, are you doing this? Are you betting on baseball? And I believe, based on my reporting, that if he's honest that day, or if he's honest at any point that spring before he digs in, the whole narrative is different. I'm not suggesting that Pete Rose wouldn't have faced a punishment. He absolutely would have. But remember, this was bad for baseball. You know, this scandal was bad for baseball in the same way that the current situation involving Shohei Ohtani and his interpreter is bad for baseball. I mean, here we are, you know, opening day, the baseball season is starting, and we're talking about gambling. We're talking about interpreters. We're talking about alleged illegal bookies. All of this is bad for baseball. This Pete Rose story back in 1989 was also bad for baseball. And Bart Giamatti, the commissioner at the time, was a man of great purity and idealism, and one of probably the smartest men who's ever led any professional sports league in America. But Bart Giamatti was also a man of empathy. And I do believe that if Pete had been honest with Bart, that Bart would have done everything in his power to save Pete Rose, to salvage him, to give him back to the game.
Bad for baseball, bad timing for baseball, Tani stuff, but great timing for Keith O'Brien, a man who just wrote a book about Pete Rose. Huh? I mean, you nailed it, man. You had no way, knowing, of course, that it was coming, but holy did you nail it, Keith.
It's crazy, right?
I know. Yeah.
Crazy.
Yeah.
And crazy. yet not even that unexpected.
You know, I mean, right, in this day and age, right?
Not unexpected. Only thing that's unexpected about this is that it involves anything having to do with our most famous ball player today, Shohei Ohtani.
That should be your next book, by the way, The Interpreter, okay? Like, dig in, get on that now. Like, get to The Interpreter, okay?
That is a good title. That's a good book title, Stu Gus.
Thank you. I like that. Thank you. Listen, 50-50, what do you think? I mean,
absolutely. Absolutely. We're in.
Last question on the way out here. What'd you learn about Pete that you didn't know before you started writing this book? I know you had a relationship with him, but did you learn anything new about Pete Rose as you were putting this book together?
I learned a lot of new things about Pete Rose, about his life, about moments. Many of those, you know, moments and scenes are part of the book. I will say the one thing that was surprising to me is something that I think would be surprising to most others, especially if you saw him play. Pete Rose does not like confrontation in his personal life.
Interesting.
He, you know, this guy who played with all of this fury on the field and would happily fight with another man at second base.
Yes.
Doesn't like confrontation.
That's odd.
And so, you know, this thing, you know, that he has done to me, where he was talking and now he's not talking to me, is something he's done to others in his life over the years. And not just reporters. You know, he's done it to, you know, guys who were in his inner circle. You know, he and in interviews I did with some of his some of the women in his life, his ex-wife, his first wife, and ex-girlfriends, they all told me Pete Rose is not the kind of guy who would have an argument with you. He would just disappear.
Amazing. Keith, we appreciate it. Keith O'Brien, New York Times bestselling author. Check out his new book, Charlie Hustle, The Rise and Fall of Pete Rose. And the last days of baseball, it's going to do great. I'm certain it's already doing great. My dad asked me for my copy. I said, Dad, it's personalized to me. So I made him go buy a book, Keith, just so you know, because Pete Rose is one of his favorite athletes of all time. So he's super excited to read this thing. We appreciate it, man. Good luck with this thing. Great timing for you. And I'm certain the book is going to do very well.
Thanks so much. I appreciate the conversation.
It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Texting privacy policy and terms and conditions posted at textplan.us. Texting enrolls for recurring automated text marketing messages. Message and data rates may apply. Reply stop to opt out. Individual results may vary. Consult a doctor prior to use.
You've lost so much weight. How'd you do it?
I got medical treatment for weight loss through Zelty and lost 50 pounds. I struggled for the longest time, but Zelty makes it easy and affordable to get weight loss treatment 100% online. Zelty providers can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications clinically shown to help people lose weight, like Wegovy, Zepbound, and others.
I've heard those medications can help you lose weight, but aren't they expensive?
Zelty can help get the medication covered by insurance, so it's as little as $0 a month.
What if you don't have insurance?
No problem. Zelty may be able to help you get other GLP-1 medications for 80 to 90% off the price of name brand medications.
I'm ready to start losing weight. How do I get started with Zelty?
Just text.
Text LOSE to 200-300 to get started today with Zelty and see if weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound are right for you. Don't wait. Text now for a link to your exclusive offer. Text LOSE to 200-300. That's LOSE to 200-300. LOSE to 200-300.
Mikey, that was pretty fascinating stuff with Keith O'Brien. Yeah, like he nailed the timing on this. Yeah, I'm insanely jealous. I don't know why I'm insanely jealous. I've never wanted to write a Pete Rose book, but he nailed the timing on this. He really did. Like with my luck, my personal record book's going to come out and Kevin Durant's going to win a title on a really bad team. Like,
yes. I mean, yes.
I say with my luck as if I haven't been the luckiest person on the planet.
I was just going to say, like your luck. Trey just.
All I've had is luck. What's the matter with me? Anyway, you're doing just fine over there. Phil Heath is going to join us. I was intimidated by him, even via Zoom. He's a very strong man.
Yeah. Yeah.
And a very nice man.
He flexed on the Zoom, and I'm pretty sure my computer bent a little.
The new movie is out, Breaking Olympia, the Phil Heath story. And we'll talk to him about that. But in honor of Phil Heath here, Mike, and I do miss doing stupidity, I have top five Heaths of all time. Wow. How about that? Yeah.
Not only is that fantastic, but that is also your second top five in one episode. I don't know that you can come up with five Heaths.
Oh, I can. I can come up with six.
All right. Number six. Wait, go.
Wait, hold on. I gotta make sure I have six here. Okay, hold on. I have an OLI. You ready? OLI. Heath Ledger. How about that?
Wow.
Probably the most famous Heath.
He's the only one I thought of. And here, wow, the Joker himself. Okay.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Yep. Top five. Number five, Heath Bell.
He's a pretty good closer.
There is not a pitcher more hated in South Florida than Heath Bell. All right, we had the new stadium. Everyone's excited. The Marlins, David Sampson, finally spent some money. He spent it on the wrong guy. He spent it on Heath Bell. Okay, yep. He was dreadful. Yes. Number four, Heath Shuler.
Nice. Okay.
He's like a senator or something, right?
He's something.
He's not a quarterback.
Not cool. Definitely not one of those.
He was a quarterback. And, of course, Washington thought he would be a good quarterback, and he was not. Number three, Heathcliff Slocum.
Wow. Wow. One of the worst trades in baseball history.
Really?
Jason Varitek and Derek Lowe for Heathcliff Slocum.
Wow, that is bad tech. Yeah, but you know what? Then you have to have Varitek on your team, and who wants that? He's not fun. It's like McCann, not that me. Guy. Not me. I just like saying that name, Heathcliff Slocum. It's a great name.
It's a great name.
Yeah. Number two. Heath Bar Crunch.
Okay.
Boom.
I don't think I've ever eaten a Heath Bar Crunch, but I know I've put it on top of ice cream.
It's a great topping for ice cream. Yeah. It really
is. It's a topping. It's
you're right. It's the rare thing. It's better as a topping than it is in its original form. You're right. I'll do top five for those next week. I'm just going to do a book of top fives. I gotta tell you, this running thing is easy. You like that? He's pointing at me.
I like that.
I know. All right, number one, because I'm terrified of him, even though I shouldn't be, because he turned out to be a really, really nice man, a kind man, the gentleman of Phil Heath, but I'm terrified of him.
Yep.
Even after interviewing him and telling the audience he is nice, he is kind, he is warm, he's kind of quiet. He's kind of shy, it seemed like, a little bit. Even knowing that now, I'm still terrified of Phil Heath. So
he's number one on any list he wants to be number one on from here until
the
turn.
Well, he told me he wanted to be number one. Don't you dare put Heath Bar Crunch in front of me. You hear me? You got it, Phil. Breaking Olympia, the Phil Heath story. Brand new movie. It is out right now. Let's talk to Phil.
He's a seven-time Mr. Olympian. Seven-time. He's a badass. Phil Heath is going to join us. He has a movie out, Breaking Olympia, the Phil Heath story. It's out right now. Phil, what's important for you in terms of what you want people to hear about your story?
I want people to watch this knowing that it's not just about lifting weights and, you know, consuming massive amounts of protein, okay? This is more just about my life, my quote-unquote last dance, and, you know, just the ups and downs and the most vulnerable pieces of who I am and where I came from and what I had to endure and how I came out on top.
What did you have to endure?
Various parts of mental health, going through Division I basketball after being, you know, a high school standout in hoops and getting that scholarship, thinking I was going to be the man, and boy, was I wrong. And just realizing that the sport of college hoops is a huge freaking business, and it is unrelenting whatsoever. I mean, it is tough. And how, you know, I had some very bad thoughts and had thoughts of suicide and, you know, tried to, you know, end it at one point. And then realizing that since I am here, I have a lot of more work to do on the inside, and just realize that I have a lot of other things to be grateful for. And although basketball isn't one of those things that's going to be my saving grace, it actually was, because it positioned me right into bodybuilding. And man, I took that thing, you know, bull by the horns and didn't let go. And it was a big, big learning lesson. I'm very happy that I was able to, you know, share that story, you know, for the viewers, because they didn't know that about me. But then also how I was able to triumph through it. And, you know, like I said, take those dumbbells, use them, but use the mind and the spirit to help me win those seven Mr. Olympia titles.
Is it fair to say bodybuilding saved your life?
I would say so. I would say bodybuilding definitely saved my life. You know, having some friends that, you know, just put their arms around me, and that had nothing to do with hoops, because of the fact that, you know, in basketball, you're in a team aspect. And then you think of bodybuilding as a singular thing. Well, yeah, you're up there by yourself, but you can have training partners. You can have people that root you on from far and from near. You just have to let them in a little bit. So yeah, you know, bodybuilding has definitely changed my whole entire life. It saved my life. And I know that it'll always be one of those anchors in my life.
What was the experience about college basketball that brought you to such a depressed, low place? Like, what was it? What was it about that experience that brought you to that place?
I felt basketball in college was difficult because of the lying. Right. You know, the sure. coaches are say whatever they want, and they can tell you, you know, hey, I need you to do X, Y, Z, and then I'll go to practice early and go work on those things. I'll exhibit that in the times that I could play, and then you just sit there, you know. And for me, it was like, all right, you go run the offense, you go do this, that, and the other, you score a couple baskets, and then you immediately get sent back on the bench. You're like, well, did I do something wrong? Why are you not letting me play? I'm actually in my groove. And it really had nothing to do with me. It had all to do with what their scheme was, what their job was. And you know, that was really hard to dissect, especially again, when you're asking for adjudication and you're being told you're doing fine, son, you're doing fine. And then you realize, no, I'm not. Fine isn't me sitting around and watching our team get our ass beat. And I want to, you know, help, you know, solve this problem. And I know I can, because I wasn't some scrub on the bench. You know, I wasn't some guy, some easy bucket in practice. I was the guy that was leading in the sprints and the drills. So, you know, when you don't have that ability to contribute and you don't see your team being successful and they're preventing you from, you know, being out there, it just hurt like hell. But I'm kind of glad it did, because it taught me that life sometimes isn't fair. You can't always have some level of entitlement, even though you do show up. You have to figure out like what's the best thing to be grateful for. And that was actually to be able to earn a great scholarship at an awesome university.
Phil, what is a simple thing that you can't do? Because I feel like you could do almost everything because of how question. Strong you are. Yes. But what's something that you can't do?
Well, I can't cook as well as my wife, that's for sure. I can't, man. Well,
can you
right
change
now,
a tire? Like, can you change a tire?
Oh, yeah, I had to learn that. Okay. I mean, I grew up in the 80s, guys. Like,
so did I, and I can't change a tire, yeah, Phil. I mean,
yeah, change the tire, you know, I mean, not on a new car, but like an old car, like, you know, master cylinders and doing all that cool stuff, you know, working on old vehicles. But yeah, I would say what I can't do right now is dunk. I used to be able to do that, and now I can't dunk anymore. Damn, I can't dunk a basketball.
Well, do you have anything that because of how strong you are that you physically like can't do that thing? Like if you had to put like an icy hot patch on your back or something, is that something that you can't do?
You can't get around to the back, you're saying? Like,
You know, playing golf right now would not be something that I would be really good at right now. It would definitely hurt my back, but I still, you know, stay limber as much as I can. But yeah, definitely I would say playing golf would be a huge, huge challenge for me because it definitely takes a lot of, you know, movement of the hips and, you know, in the back and all that stuff. Your thoracic spine, all those things gets compromised, you know, lifting all those weights.
When you physically feel right, though, you're a good golfer. Is that?
I army golf. You know what that is?
No.
Left, right, left.
You spray it all over the fairway, Phil, is what you're saying.
Yeah. And if it goes straight, it's not going far. That's my problem. Yeah. So I need some help.
Right. Well, you know, how can you not hit the ball far?
Well, that's the thing. I would think that people see you and they think,
hit it straight. You know, I'm like slicing that thing. It's literally going 275 yards that way. I'm like trying to get it straight. And then you see some kid go out there and knock it 300 yards. You're like, yeah, I suck. This is not good. And it, you know, of course they're like, yeah, look at the big guy, you know.
I feel like in that sense, it's annoying to be that strong, right? Because like people probably come up to you all the time and like, oh, he probably hits it 500 yards. Or like anytime someone wants to get ketchup out of like a jar or something, like, oh, Phil can open this jar for us. And then, you know, there's always that jar you can't open. There's no explaining right. it.
I love the idea, the visual of Phil trying to twist and off a mayo jar.
It. Yeah.
It's the guy that what we see, we saw like a, there was a clip, it was from a few years ago, but a guy like with the water bottle and he couldn't twist it. Yeah. I saw that and I was like, oh man, you're making big guys look bad, dude. Like this is bad. At that point, you should have just bit the damn thing off, you know, like just went full, you know. Full carnal, like just went full caveman on that thing.
How many times has Phil Heath bitten things off?
Right, exactly. Not very often.
Don't
have to, but yeah, no. The grip strength is something that you learn very, very quickly if you have it or you don't.
Right.
I will say I don't have like the craziest grip strength that like let's say a Brian Shaw, like a world's strongest man has, but it's pretty good. It's pretty good.
When did you know, Phil, that you wanted that bodybuilding was going to be something you would do for a living?
I knew right when I won the Mr. USA in 2005.
Okay.
Right then and there, I was like, wait a minute. I just won my pro card. I have the cover of Flex magazine that same night. I already signed with them a month prior, but now I get to renegotiate. Wait a minute, I'm getting paid? I'm getting paid to go to the gym. I'm getting paid to do the cardio. I'm getting paid to eat. Wait a minute. I can get a food sponsor. I can get a, you know, equipment sponsor. I can get a supplement sponsor. Huh? This works out pretty damn good. As long as I just show up and show out, like this life is great. And I get to travel the world.
Right.
You know, I get to meet a lot of people, man. This is really neat. So you just have to get over one major thing. That you got to train hard and do all those things, but you got to wear those posing trunks. That isn't easy. So that's something that we know a lot of people, they want to train, they want to do their thing. You know, they want to maybe lift up the shirt and show off the abs in the mirror.
Sure.
They ain't putting no damn trunks on and going up on stage and being adjudicated. Yeah. That's a whole nother animal.
I'm tempted to ask you to take the shirt off right now. I want to see the guns. I want to see it all. I mean,
I'll give you a bicep.
Hold let me see a bicep. Look at that. Oh my God. Oh my God. What is going on?
I'm looking at his forearms. Are huge too.
Wait, so what goes in first from a physical standpoint? Like what type, like what goes in to reach your level, which is the highest of levels? What kind of training are you doing for this? Like, what do you do? Give us, give the audience a feel of what it takes to get to arrive where you arrived.
You know what's funny? I'm doing the same workouts that they're seeing online.
Really?
But I'm just doing it better.
Right.
That's it. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm just doing it better. It's like when I was talking about the, hitting that golf ball, I can hit it. It ain't going to go anywhere where I want it to go. For me, I'm able to pick up, I know how to pick up a set of dumbbells, barbells, machines. I know how to use them. I know how to use these tools probably a lot better than the most other people. I can take the ego out of the weight session. And that is huge because the last thing you want to do is lift incorrectly and tear something and do it for YouTube or something, you know, like we have that going on. So I just know how to make sure that with the data that I've acquired over the past 20 years, what foods work for me, you know, what type of training, is it high volume? Is it low volume? Is it a combination of both? And how to peak for shows when we, you know, all the different types of foods that you guys look at online, all these fad diets and stuff, I'm able to actually look at that and say, that's not going to work for my body type because I know what works. And I also get massive amounts of blood work done. So I know what I'm allergic to. I just know these things. I just have as much data and I'm able to make it work. And that's where the common person, you know, they don't do those things. And I also do a ton of freaking recovery. You know, I'm the guy that's in the infrared sauna, the cold plunge. I'm doing the acupuncture, the hyperbaric. You know, I remember Tim Tebow doing hyperbaric, and I was like, I need to get one of those today. And I did. I went ahead and got it. So I'm always looking for that 1% or even 0.1% advantage.
Do you have an example of one of those things that you thought was the 1% advantage that you then tried and you're like, this is just a bunch of crap? No, this is just, you know, this is a scam.
Oh, the shake weight.
Oh, you did not buy Come a shake on, weight. Phil.
I mean, really? You fell for that?
You didn't buy a shake weight, Phil.
Mike knew it. You know, like, yeah, you know, look, you know, I was using that thing. I was like, wait a minute. More forearms, right? You know, I'm like, man, you know, let's see. Then you're doing this.
Right.
I'm like, I won. that's what I was practicing for, is to be able to hold, you know, you're doing this and you're doing that. You know, you're just getting ready to, you know.
Right. For number eight.
Yes. Number eight. Exactly. Breaking Olympia, the Phil Heath story. It is out right now. And Phil Heath is with us here. What hurts the most on your body right now, Phil? I know you've had some mental stuff that you've had to deal with, but physically, what is the part of your body that hurts right now the most?
You know, my left knee, I ain't gonna lie. I had a torn MCL and, didn't require surgery or anything. It's just, you know, I did stem cells a couple years back and now I'm like, yeah, I'm going to need another round of that. Mid back, just from sitting so much, you know, I have to move around more. I had to change up my whole entire, you know, training protocol, like not just weightlifting, but like doing freaking Pilates with the wife, you know, like we're going to Pilates. I'm like, what is this? And next, you know, just opening everything up. So I'm just trying to stay as limber as possible. But yeah, I would say the mid back and my left knee. But, you know, I'm able to move, you know, pretty comfortably, to be quite honest. So I'm thanking God for that every day.
Are you the greatest bodybuilder of all time?
Man,
come on,
I sit
Phil.
On that Rushmore. That's for damn sure. I sit up there with Ronnie Coleman, Lee Haney, and Arnold. Ain't no one gonna come after us. So, you know, to be in that conversation is everything to me. I respect those eras, and I let the internet figure that one out. But it would have been one hell of a show for all four of us. That's for sure.
I'll take it. Listen, you're putting yourself on the Mount Rushmore. I'll take that. You're not gonna say you're better than Arnold. You're not gonna say you're the greatest ever. But putting yourself on the Mount Rushmore, that's acceptable to me, Phil.
Yeah.
You're looking for my acceptance, right? Breaking Olympia, the Phil Heath story is out now. Since you played basketball, since you were a two guard, we'll finish up with this question. We play a game around here. It's called Shot for Your Life, okay? So you got to choose a guy who's going to take a shot. If he hits it, you stay alive. If he doesn't, well, you know what happens. You know the outcome there. So Steph Curry or Larry Bird? You need a three-pointer for your life here, okay? Steph Curry, Larry Bird, Shot for Your Life.
Larry Bird.
Oh, you're alive.
Yeah.
Yep.
He gets the game.
Larry Bird.
Yes.
That's with the shooting jacket still on.
With the jacket still, my man. Yes. Yes. Even though Curry is a way better three-point shooter. Yes. Right. You go Bird, right?
I'm going Bird, man. Yes. I mean, like, come on. Like, he doesn't lose a three-point shootout.
Never. Right.
Who's coming in second, right?
Right. Nobody. Right. That's Larry Bird is always the answer, Phil. Well done. Phil Heath, Breaking Olympia, the Phil Heath story. It's out right now. Phil, we really appreciate this. You're too nice. For such a menacing man, you are too nice, sir.
Thank you. I carry myself that way.
I want you to be meaner.
You want me to turn green and stuff like that. That's for David Banner. That's not for Phil.
You're too nice of a guy. Phil, we appreciate it. Good luck with the movie, man.
Thank you so much, guys.
Stu Gatz here for my friends over at Miller Lite. A lot's changed over the years. One thing that hasn't, the great taste of Miller Lite. Another thing that hasn't changed is that it's less filling. So, what is the best thing about the original light beer? Miller Lite sparked this debate in 1975, and we still haven't settled it. For me, it is simple. What I want out of my light beer is ice cold and great taste, and that's exactly what I get from the original light beer, Miller Lite. Miller Lite keeps it simple, undebatable quality, great taste, only 96 calories. It's the beer that strips away everything you don't need and holds on to what matters most, a light beer that tastes like beer. You don't have to choose what's best. Miller Lite has great taste and is less filling. Tastes like Miller time. To get Miller Lite delivered right to your door, visit MillerLite.com/Stu, or you can find it pretty much anywhere that sells beer. Celebrate responsibly. Miller Brewing Company, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, 96 calories per 12 ounces, fewer calories and carbs than premium regular beer.